All right, welcome back to another edition of the Sunstone Podcast. I'm your host, John Larson, and we're here on a beautiful, I guess it's still the summer morning. And we've brought back one of my favorite individuals to talk with, somebody who really sort of understands how interesting philosophically Mormonism can be, and that's Blair Osler. Welcome back.
Thanks so much. I'm happy to be here.
Now, Sunstone was last week. You guys did a whole bunch of stuff up there, the transhumanists.
Yeah. We had the MTA Sunstone track, which was really great. We got a lot of good traffic coming through. We also had our, we were being filmed for a documentary as well. So we had a documentary crew, and it was really fun. Just a lot of fun. The documentary crew was like, wow, I'm surprised how progressive Mormonism is. And I had to explain to them, you're getting a very biased sample of Mormonism here at Sunstone.
That's true. Yeah. Sunstone is especially the annual conference is a really great mix and mingle. Mm-hmm. Even though I try to limit my interaction with Mormonism, even through Sunstone, the main conference is such a, well, they're all delightful, but it's such a delight because you have people of all stripes. And who else besides Lindsay Hanson Park could organize a kickball game between fundamentalists and ex-Mormons?
Right.
I mean, totally. I was walking through the Sunstone offices here just yesterday, and there were the two hats. And I was thinking, you know, man, oh man, in our history, has anybody done anything like this?
No, before? Not at all.
and it's just this wonderful mix of believers and non-believers. And I only got in a big argument with one fella, but he was a mission president for a fundamentalist sect there, proselyting. So I kind of let him have it with both barrels. So I feel a little bit bad about that, but not really. But that was a private conversation. You see all these people there just mingling and talking. And it's the people who really love Mormonism, you know?
It really is. It's definitely a group of people who are just head over heels still involved in Mormonism. And you just, you know, got a Mormon.
And you say involved, it's true, but I would guess the activity rate for people who go to Sunstone is probably less than 20%. But sure, there are a lot of active people going, you know?
Yeah.
And it models what, you know, it's people who are interested in Mormonism for all sorts of levels, philosophically, historically, as a social experiment, because they believe it, because they want to redeem it, they want something better, they want to deal with the pain, and there's just a million different approaches to this.
Yeah.
So speaking of different approaches, we're here to talk about Mormon transhumanism, right?
Yes. I know. I'm super excited because most people usually want to talk to me about queer Mormonism, and I'm really excited to talk about Mormon transhumanism.
When it comes to LGBT and queer issues, I have many friends. I know everybody says that, like I have my black friend or whatever, but
and, you have your token queer friends
and children and. It honestly has become like a non-issue for me. And I really don't understand why anybody gives a crap. Like who anybody sleeps with.
Right.
And I see human sexuality as complex and on a spectrum. Mm-hmm. So I don't mean to be dismissive of your queer identity, but I don't give a shit.
That's okay. No, that's the hope of the future, that there's no such thing as like queer activism or feminism or anything like that, because we all just treat each other like really nice human beings. So the goal eventually is to not need these tools anymore.
Right. And I know that's happening in the queer community with things like Pride, where, you know, Pride used to be this coming out and there's a lot of identity, and now that's full of corporate sponsors and stuff. And I'm like, yeah, welcome to the rest of the world. It's sometimes it's nice. I can remember when I was young and a Mormon and taking a lot of identity about being the other, the one special people, and being a minority. And that's why, you know, some people say, well, if the church starts slipping in membership, is everyone going to realize when it's declining? No, it's going to speak to the faith of the people who stick around faithfully.
Right. This is where you get the wheats and tares narrative, right?
Yes. They love to tell that story
uh-huh.
these days.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I say to them, well, this is in my mind. I'm a lot cooler in my head than I am in real life. You know, well, the very elect will be deceived, and I'm not elect. So that must be you.
I always say, gosh, I'm so impressed you counted me among the elect. What a compliment.
Okay, so I do have a fascination with Mormon philosophy, especially because people accept it, and it's so new. It hasn't had 1,000 years to work all the kinks out. And I think transhumanism is an approach to that. And it's one that I don't understand very well, so I'm going to ask you some naive questions. I want you to push back on me. But why don't we start and just say, well, what is it? Why aren't you just Mormons? Why Mormon transhumanists?
Right. So transhumanism as a philosophical movement is generally a secular movement led primarily by atheists. But transhumanism is the idea that we should use science and technology to radically enhance the human experience, to improve humanity, to cure diseases, things like that. So how that involves Mormonism, well, Mormonism strangely has some doctrines that are very compatible with this idea of building a better world, building a better community, and enhancing the human experience. So for example, in Mormonism, we have the idea of theosis. We're going to all become God someday. Well, the secular transhumanist narrative is like, we'll someday have powers that are indistinguishable from God's because we have science and technology and ways of achieving things that couldn't have been achieved before. So when you put the two ideas parallel together, they go hand in hand quite nicely.
They do. There's so much to unpack here, and it's just fascinating. I'm trying to figure out which direction to go.
No, take your time.
So I guess, first of all, let's take the transhumanist side, and then we can come kind of back into Mormonism. And maybe I'm going to start by with a criticism for you guys to kind of respond to. You know, it shows up in science fiction movies all the time as a dystopian,
right?
As science and technology might improve our lifespan or make us immune to disease, cure cancer, the fear, and we're already there actually, is that these will be unequally distributed among the elites. So does transhumanism sort of embrace that and say, well, yeah, maybe to improve humanity, only 5% get this? Or is there any idea of egalitarianism or collectivism?
No, that's a great question. And I would say, first of all, opinions are going to vary within the transhumanist community on how...
You don't have like a prophet of transhumanism.
No, we don't have a transhumanist prophet. We all disagree. It's a great big democracy. So every transhumanist is going to have a different opinion on it. Some of them are more capitalistic and some of them are more communal. So for someone like me, I am greatly concerned with the idea of technological accessibility. People need to be able to be, one, technologically literate to a certain extent, and two, being able to have the means or ability to get access to these technologies. Sometimes this can be a concern for people because, like you mentioned, what happens when the rich and elite have these technologies and literally have the ability to start controlling all sorts of things in very oppressive manners? And my argument is that's already the case, and we need to fight that right now. This isn't a future problem. This is a right now problem. And so being able to get technology accessible to people is the problem. It's not necessarily the technology itself. Mild example would be not all women across the globe have access to really good prenatal care. Does that mean we should stop giving good prenatal care to all women? No, we work on the accessibility to get it to all women. Unfortunately, it has been done in a way to where, look, rich people get it first. But I think that needs to change. We need to start closing that gap. And there are a lot of programs being done to help that. So like recently, I think it was Mark Cuban and Serena Williams have opened up a foundation to help with black maternal mortality rates, because it's far worse for black women than it is white women. And so these are the types of programs we need to be promoting.
Then we could say transhumanism, and at least in one part, is really about improving the human condition.
Exactly, yes.
And then it might be a little bit unfair for eggheads like me to come and say, well, you're distributing that unequally, because that philosophically, that's not part of it.
Exactly. This is just a problem all around, the inequitable distribution of things. So, but it is a transhumanist problem in the sense that, like, our technologies, our knowledge and things are increasing at such a rapid rate in ways that the stratification could really extend to something as like strange speciesism where we could literally start changing our DNA, changing our genetics and things like that to where a species is purchased by the highest bidder. So it is a transhumanist problem, but it's also much more than a transhumanist problem. This is an everybody problem.
And I'm really concerned in this world about the Dunning-Kruger effect, which it's oftentimes used as an insult, but basically it's a psychological phenomena where if you don't understand something, like you're ignorant, not stupid, ignorant. There's things you don't know. You underestimate your lack of knowledge. So we see this politically coming out, but I'm not using this to take like pot shots at the right or the left. But oftentimes political stances are non-scientific. I'll give you an easy example. In any economics 101 class, they can explain to you historically why trade tariffs don't work. It's sort of just a standard thing that you can take a let's say 13-year-old through, do the math, and then you'll understand very well that the trade tariffs don't work. And economists on the left, on the right, communist economists, socialist economists, capitalists, they all agree to a high degree, 90-something percent, that these don't work, and we have plenty of historical evidence. But that does take a little bit of work to understand what I just said.
Yes.
I mean, you either accept what I just said as a tenet of faith and say, oh, well, I believe John, or you go in and do the work. You take an econ class. Well, most of the world doesn't take an econ class. They don't have the means to do that.
Right. Not everyone even can.
So you have a lot of people making trade policy decisions and us voting for leaders from a place of ignorance. And I'm just using that not to make fun of people, but to say, the world is getting so complicated. Science, as it moves out, there's such a foundation of what you need to know. These guys, like in the Age of Enlightenment, who, you know, like Newton and all these who made all these different discoveries in all these different areas, that's not happening anymore because it takes a long time to get out to the edge. But the challenge we all face in humanity is none of us can really understand the edge. Well, I've tried to read books. I'm not a dummy. I've tried to read several books on like particle physics and stuff, and it is way over my head.
Right. Well, at some point, you do have to trust in other disciplines, right? I mean, I'm a philosopher. I'm not a scientist. I'm not going to pretend to be a scientist.
Wait, every philosopher knows that science is just a subset of philosophy.
Exactly. It's true. Everything is a subset of philosophy. Let's just be honest here. But as a philosopher, there are things that I need to relinquish my own epistemic arrogance of things I know and don't know. You see this all the time with like something simple like vaccinations. This is a transhumanist issue that not everybody is scientifically literate enough to understand how vaccination saves lives. We still have people who don't want to vaccinate their children. And a lot of that comes down to scientific literacy. And it's a problem. So it's difficult because at some point you do have to trust in disciplines outside your own. But at the same time, that gets people into trouble too, because then you start to trust like the flat earther who's claiming all these unrealistic claims about the way the universe works.
I like that you're framing it that way because, much to my chagrin, I've come to the conclusion that any belief system entails a lot of faith because we can't process things. I use the example when I say this to my friend. I get pushback when I say this to my friends a lot, and then I say, "All right," I put a piece of paper in front of them and say, "Prove the Pythagorean theorem," and I would say 99 out of 100 people can't do it.
Right.
I can do it because I say that to people. So
you're like, so, I use my own example.
So I had to learn to do it, but I had to learn to over and over and over again. But there's so many things that we've accepted, and this is one of the problems of science. Even if you get a really rigorous scientific education, you really don't have time to go through and rigorously prove all of the postulates and theorems that you're accepting. Now, so then we have to start putting faith in institutions, in the academy, and where people who are anti-science, even on a, which is most of us, in some place, we criticize, we see scientific revolution happening where science gets caught on a bad idea, and it's true. They've had a lot of history of this.
Right, like racism.
Like that was eugenics.
Exactly,
Lamarckian,
sure.
Evolutionary theory and things like this. But science is self-correcting. It usually just takes generations to do it. And I think one of the key differences between science and religion is not the exorcism of faith. It's that religion tends to have no self-correcting mechanism.
Or I would even say maybe a slower self-correcting system. Oh, so the scientific method has this way of self-correcting at maybe a more rapid rate, or I almost dare I say even more accurate. I mean, science is a tool that, like no other tool, has been more accurate in describing the way the world as we experience. Religion has some self-correcting tools, but they tend to be really slow. And you're dealing with large bodies of population, right? So those self-correcting principles tend to take a really long time. You know, eventually what black men were eventually ordained the priesthood, that's probably an example of self-correcting and things like that. But that was unbelievably slow and took place far longer than it needed to.
Now, I have to, there's something I have to correct here, because it's a personal pet peeve of mine, one that I've done. We frame out the issue of African Americans and Mormonism always with black men in the priesthood. But let's be clear, black women were not allowed to go to the temple and get their saving.
Correct.
And black women were not allowed to pray in church and all these kind of things.
Right.
So yes, you're absolutely right. And I think the biggest self-correcting mechanism of religion is new religions form. Mm-hmm. And I noticed years ago when I was studying religion that if you took a snap of any religion, this includes Mormonism, when they're founded, like say 1830, into the 1840s, the science that gets baked into religion is current with the time. So I think sometimes what happens with religions, they give us a social glue, and I think there's a part of our psychology that actually needs them. Collectively, as a whole. Individually, that's not true. There's people who function just fine without religion. But I think on a society level, I've come to the conclusion that we need it for various reasons. There's probably too much to go into today. But I think religions tend to have a life cycle where they're on the upswing. They provide people a lot of structure, community, child rearing, support for women, especially. You can measure a religion by how well it supports widows or how well it supports, you know, mentally handicapped people and that sort of stuff. But then it reaches a peak and it starts to decline because society's changed enough that it stops being valuable. And then it goes into its conservative sort of angry phase until it peters out. But new religions will form. I think we live in an age that we're a combustible petri dish ready for a new world religion to spring on. It may have already happened, because those first 100 years or so, you know, it's going to get... But this is a cycle we've been in.
Well, and I think science and technology is going to play a huge part in that. We are a technological society, and science is more reliable than any other tool we have right now. And so our religions are definitely morphing to coincide with those views to a certain extent. Of course, there are outliers who are going to deny certain things, like, I don't know, the age of the earth or the shape of it, for that matter. But generally, these new kind of emerging ideas, religions, mythologies, and ideas, they're going to involve science and technology. And that's very much what I see transhumanism is. And I know secular atheist transhumanists will be upset at me for saying this, but transhumanism is a religious myth. It's just using a different language to describe a similar narrative, the idea that we want people to live eternally, we want people to be healthy, we want to heal the sick and cure the blind, and so on and so forth. These are the same stories, just different narratives.
Very true. And I think one of the big problems is this world is so complicated, more complicated than you can ever understand. And when we look at things like Mormonism, I have to remind myself, it is way more complicated than I can ever wrap my head around, or anybody. And this goes to what we were talking about a minute ago with life. So whatever kind of philosophical construct or religious construct you have, it's a way to simplify the world. And you can, from a philosophical perspective, you can criticize that out the gate. Because you're saying, as soon as you start like cutting things up and saying, this is a verb, this is a noun, this is this part, this is this part, you've immediately lost the big picture. And I know we're sounding really Zen Buddhist here, which is really true. You do lose the big picture, but I don't know if there's any other way for our minds to do it.
Well, and I think it's also worth noting that we're storytellers. We've been drawing our stories on cave walls since our existence, since we had language, and we told stories about where the sky came from, where the moon came from. And as science has improved, our stories change a little bit, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we've lost our desire to tell a story, to yearn for something beyond what's been given right in front of us. Our idea that we need to transform the world, transform ourselves, and make something better than what it is right now. Stories play an essential role in that.
Well, and I see that even here in like the podcasting format. You know, I can sit down and write something and annotate it and be very careful, and it'll be much better than sort of the mediocrity that I schlock out on the podcast. But we've been listening to stories and communicating verbally much longer than we've been communicating even visually. Because you would think that like a podcast that's a YouTube that has pictures behind it would be more powerful. It's not. Because without the visual element, you get right into people's head. And the reason I bring that up is that that's very important for how religions transmit. And it was very important as the ex-Mormon movement especially started gaining steam, say, 20 years ago, because we had the tools to connect with one another verbally in real life. So I think that that's really true.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely think there's also something important about what you're saying, this idea of transmitting ideas and transmitting stories and things like that. And I think that transhumanism, it really is one of those ways of transitioning Mormonism from, I don't mean this entirely critically, but maybe from a superstitious lens to a more practical lens. It's a practical take on Mormonism. So in Mormonism, you go in and you do temple ordinances to be redeem your dead. You do baptism for the dead and all sorts of things. Transhumanists take it a step further, and I would say the religious transhumanist would say, or the Mormon transhumanist would say something along the lines of, well, it's nice to do those rituals, and those rituals good are insofar as they provoke you to further action. You know, if we really want to achieve these things by redeeming the dead, well, let's talk about how we're seriously going to do that. Let's dive into the science of it. Let's see what we can come up with beyond the importance of a ritual.
Yeah, so now as we start diving back into Mormonism, I think Mormonism sits in an interesting place because you have church leaders, church prophets who are very progressive. We'll say Joseph Smith, Wilfred Woodruff, Orson Pratt, B.H. Roberts, some of these guys who were very much about embracing science and wanting to learn and bring all these things in. And then you have folks like Ezra Taft Benson or Boyd K. Packer, to name ones more recent, who are very, like, you know, almost stoic in their approach to the outside world, and that's giving them too much credit, but very protective of the institution. And when I say the institution, of course, it implies all sorts of negative things. But for them, they're thinking about all the people they help, the people they feed, the people they give structure to. So I see in Mormonism this 200-year history of this tension between embracing the modern world. They run a university, and it's not Bob Jones. BYU is not Bob Jones.
Right.
It has Bob Jones-esque elements, but they're usually in the back corners. Mm-hmm. In almost every area, of study, there's real scientific research and things make progress. But on the other hand, we have some archaic anti-intellectual elements. So Mormonism is an interesting spot to interact with transhumanism.
There definitely is an interesting relationship with Mormonism and its ability to embrace science and technology and new ideas in a modern world. Generally, at least in my observation, I would say the church generally has favorable views about science and technology and incorporating these things. Of course, like we've done all sorts of things from missionaries to being able to have communication with them and things like that. So the church does embrace science and technology to a certain extent. And to me, the defining difference between when the church is going to accept or reject something scientific or technological usually has to do with authority structures. If it's a piece of information or science or technology that's going to threaten the current patriarchal gerontocracy authority structure, it's more likely to be rejected. Of course, this isn't like a universal application. There's going to be, exceptions to the rule. But if it's something that doesn't threaten the patriarchal gerontocracy, it's something to likely be embraced. Something even simple like Nelson's comments about, you know, take your vitamin pills, like, to be healthy. You know, the brethren aren't like, no, we reject modern medicine and things like that. No, Nelson is a heart surgeon, so he definitely has some certainly favorable views of science and technology, but heart surgery doesn't threaten the patriarchal gerontocracy. Trans technologies threaten the patriarchal gerontocracy. So it is a complicated relationship.
Well, it's funny that, as you pointed out, the science they embrace, like we tend to be very, as LDS people, very much embracing medicine.
Right.
Like in all the talks about addiction and all that kind of stuff, I think this is, and this is a bigger American thing too, you know, opioids were based on opium. And, like, we've known the problems of opium since hell, there were opium dens openly running in Salt Lake City until the 20s and 30s, right? Like, we knew the perils of opium. Mm-hmm. But the idea that because this came through, even though we can see the story of this profit-driven, like, saturating America with it, it's really hard for the church even today to get up and condemn opioids because it came through this scientific element through medicine.
And, well, I would even say an authority, right? There's an authority in a prescription. Mm-hmm. There's an authority in that. And unfortunately, there is Latter-day Saints really like that authority, that prescription, the stamp of approval, the benevolent patriarch saying this is something is okay. So it's really hard for people to come out against technologies or prescriptions or anything that defy the existing authority structure.
Well, and I think that's one of the reasons there's so much still latent resistance to marijuana, because if you open the floodgates, well, it's a plant, and it's a plant that's not that hard to grow,
right?
So there's really, once you go to that point, there's no way to control it.
Mm-hmm.
So I like what you're saying, because I wonder if that element fits in. Opioids, which are far more dangerous than marijuana, by just not even comparable. They're okay. And Mormons struggle. Utah is a higher, we're not as bad as some of the places like in Appalachia, but mm-hmm. it's pretty high for opioid deaths and problems with prescription painkillers and that sort of stuff because of that over-reliance on authority. But again, as we started this discussion, to me, that's an embracing of a certain times of, like you're saying, an authoritarian science, because we get that.
Right.
But like a communal sort of scientific understanding. There's folk elements in that Mormonism, but the institution doesn't embrace it.
Yeah. Then the weird thing is both are strangely Mormonism, right? Like, in Mormonism, we do have, like, this strong authoritarian view of what things are supposed to be and how they are. And then on the other side, we believe that the earth is going to be renewed to its paradisical glory, and we're all going to be polygamous, and we have herbs, and the times there's, like, sometimes I wonder why we're not just a bunch of, like, polyamorous hippie children, because it's all there in Mormonism too. So it really is just this weird blend of all sorts of different ideas competing with each other.
It's a great example you bring up, because it's this paradox that I've run into before. You'll have Mormons who have, you know, a half a ton of wheat in their basement.
Right.
But you ask them, well, you know, key elements that they always talk about, like fuel, cooking oil, water, and your medications. I mean, those things are going to be more critical to you than wheat. And the answer is, well, God will take care of that. So it's really this strange mix of highly pragmatic, you know, to the point you're canning peaches to survive the apocalypse before Jesus gets here.
Right.
But on the other hand, your medication that you'll die without, you just say it's in God's hands.
Yeah, that is peculiar, isn't it?
But it's Mormon. I mean, like we have the Huntsman Cancer Institute, which is highly scientific, regional, one of the best centers of cancer in the United States, in the world, the only big regional one, you know, within 1,000 miles of here. And you also have the headquarters of all these MLMs.
Right.
Selling lavender oil to cure cancer. And that you have to take those twin towers together, you know.
Right. Well, and it sets up an interesting paradigm, too, for where the future is going and with the technologies coming on the horizon, right? We have all sorts of strange things, like we have cryonics now and all sorts of ideas about life extension and how to end aging and things like that. And I find a hard time believing that the prophets are going to come out and say, no, thanks, I'm not going to take that new medication life extension thing. I'm going to go ahead and let myself die. I have a hard time believing prophets are going to reject something like that. But at the same time, we have what you're talking about, all this other view of, oh, well, it's in God's hands, we'll let God take care of it and things like that. So it will be very interesting to see how it plays out.
Well, Mormonism is in fact a victim of healthcare science, because the average age of our prophets is getting older and older and older, because we're able oftentimes to, I think we're already to a point where we can extend life beyond the quality of life point. But that's a hugely difficult philosophical question. And it starts to feel like, well, down some paths that we've walked as humanity before, we don't want to walk again. But I've seen research to suggest that over the last 40 years, about half the time, the president of the church, the prophet, is incapacitated, usually mentally, because they're very old. and they oftentimes don't achieve full leadership position until their mid-90s.
Yeah.
And you can see the dynamics of the church shifting that way, because it's been a long time since we had, the last really dynamic leader we had was Hinckley, but he had been in the first presidency for so long, he was able to shape that, and we don't have that kind of dynasty anymore. It's just kind of this wild west of the next old guy takes over, and there's not really good direction, but this is an element where it cuts both ways, technology.
Right. Well, and it's interesting, like as a Mormon transhumanist too, I advocate for all sorts of ideas about anti-aging and radical life extension and all sorts of great technologies and stuff. But one thing that does make me question all this is patriarchal gerontocracies or lifetime positions and things like that. Because when people can live to be 150, and let's say we've even developed technologies to extend the quality of life, not just the quantity, but also the quality of life. You're still mentally and physically capable of doing things. But when we have leaders in positions of power for an extended period of time, that does make me question things. And again, it doesn't make me question as much my transhumanist views as much as it does the way we need to start reframing authoritarian and structural views of how we engage in governments, religions, and other communities.
So true. So as a transhumanist Mormon organization, which elements of Mormonism do you guys focus on in particular? What are your favorite parts of Mormonism?
Oh my gosh. So if you ask any Mormon transhumanist, they'll probably, I could almost guarantee you, each of them will say, we can consider Joseph Smith's King Follett sermon to be canon. The way that's where he lays out the idea of God was once a human and then became a God, and that we have the potential to become gods too. So one of the key and interesting things that Mormon transhumanists really like is theosis, divinization, the idea that someday we're going to become gods. And we're going to grow up to be gods and do cool god stuff and then make more cool little gods. That sounds like a really fun idea to most Mormon transhumanists. Risky and cautionary idea as well, but also fun. Another important one, I would say, is the idea of an immersive discipleship of Christ. I would say most Mormon transhumanists would agree that Christ doesn't end with Jesus. We are all meant to join Jesus, and we are all meant to participate in these miracles, and we are all meant to take on an immersive role of Christ and become Christ and saviors ourselves and to do these things. It's a very immersive and practical take. I would say the third thing is definitely the idea of renewing the earth to its paradisiacal glory, is the idea that we have a planet. This is where heaven was literally prophesied to be. We literally should make this heaven. We should be earnestly invested in the conservation of the planet, preservation of things, and so on and so forth. So I would say those are three really key Mormon transhumanist doctrines that Mormon transhumanists like.
It's probably happened to everyone. You're sitting in Sunday school and suddenly you think, wait a minute, I've heard this all before, about 100 times. I'm ready for something new. Well, I'm happy to report that your dream Sunday school class is just a click away at the Sunstone Magazine podcast. Here, you get to hear the best Sunstone articles in an audible quality package. You'll hear about everything, from the first vision to feminism, from LGBT issues to scriptural interpretation, from polygamy to poetry, from scholarship to mysticism, from personal essay to fiction. Listen to some of our free episodes at patreon.com/sunstone. Come join the Sunday school class you wish you had.
Interesting. Well, I hope then there's a moral component, because in a way, if you take God has all these powers, if you look at the history of humanity, we keep taking powers away from God to ourselves, and it usually doesn't end well for us. You know, like technology to, let's say, grow more crops has often resulted in market manipulation and global poverty as much as it's feeding everybody. So how do transhumanists fight against the problem that technology is amoral. It can go either way.
Exactly. No, you hit the nail on the head. The technology isn't the problem. The problem's us. We are collecting all this power and things like that, but what are we going to do with it? And I think that's where it goes into point number two of us joining the body of Christ as Jesus is the chief exemplar. And what did Jesus say the most important commandment was? Love God, love each other. That includes yourself. Love, love, love. Thou shalt love. That is the greatest commandment. So if what we're doing with these technologies, if what we're doing with these powers isn't in keeping with, I would say, the greatest commandment, which is thou shalt love, then we're failing ourselves. The question is, the power is coming. Like, the train has left the station. Technology is advancing at a very rapid rate. The real question is, what kind of gods do we want to be? Do we want to be the kind of gods that exploit cheap labor, that exclude immigrants who come here looking for a better life? What kind of gods do we want to be? Or do we want to be benevolent gods? Do we want to be like Jesus? Do we want to be compassionate creators? Do we want to help heal? Do we want to help sit with the sinners and hang out with the lepers? Like, what kind of gods do we want to be? The technology's coming. These are the questions we need to be asking ourselves.
Well, this speaks to me because it sounds like you've kind of almost come full circle through Western science into Eastern philosophy, you know, because in ancient Hinduism and modern Hinduism and a lot of our Eastern views, the separation between humanity and God is not as pronounced as in Western, you know, in Western Judeo-Christian sort of traditions. We should acknowledge the Zoroastrians and this, and even the Babylonians. They were very binary, but this idea that we're separate from God, or we're estranged from God, or God is the other, and we're down here as humanity. For Eastern views, it's very much, you know, we are a piece of God. We're a piece of the universe. Our soul is part of this bigger collective. We are God. And the reason I think that is very instructive today is it lends to a belief of, rather than God redeeming the earth through fire, like a lot of Christians and Muslims and not so much Jews these days, but this belief that, well, God, it's going to get terrible, yeah, and God's going to fix it. Go ahead.
Right. No, you're totally right. Sorry, I got so very excited. It's the idea that God redeems it through us, mm-hmm, that we are doing this. And Mormonism is strangely primed for this kind of Eastern idea. We have this idea that we're co-eternal with gods.
Right.
It says in the scripture, ye are gods. And someday you get to become a big God with a big G, with like the other gods that have existed in worlds without ends. And so we have this very strange idea in Mormonism that's, I shouldn't say strange, but strangely Eastern, and that we are co-eternal with God. God works through us. We are God's hands on earth.
Well, and related to that, I think philosophically, the single most interesting idea in Mormonism that nobody really unpacks is Alma 32, in which Alma says that God could cease to be God if he quit following the rules.
Right.
Because that just explodes this philosophical thing. Like, well, then who the hell wrote the rules?
Right.
You know, where did these come from? And of course, Mormons speak, and I know that when we talk about God and that stuff, it's oftentimes metaphoric, even though Mormons believe it's literal. But they speak out of both sides of their mouth when it comes to God. They talk about God being a creator, even though they know in their theology God created nothing. God just followed a pattern. And so, mm-hmm, God really didn't really exercise any, you know, say, well, because Mormons will still use this as the solution by complexity. Say the world is so complicated that we need a God to describe it.
Right.
Even though Mormon theology doesn't support that.
God is a story. God is a story. And whether you're an atheist or a theist, whether you consider yourself secular or whatever, I think this is an idea that hopefully most people can agree on, is the idea that we are shaping God as God is shaping us. This is a project in which we're working on together. And whether God is nothing more than the imaginary projections of our own desires for something better, or whether there is actually some literal consciousness that constitutes as God, is not necessarily as relevant to me as the idea that we embrace this idea that we're doing God's work with God.
Well, and there's been many different models. I actually have this. I have a lot of papers I've started, and my ADE doesn't allow me to finish them all the time. But mm-hmm, where I'm talking about, I think I have up to five different models of God that are all kind of mutually exclusive that exist in Mormonism, mm-hmm, and you can see these things come about. You know, there's the philosophical idea that God is the extension of the ideal patriarch.
Or, oh, yes.
So which you can see, like, it's when you read this Bronze Age book, the Bible, you know, God acts like a jealous, petty, insecure king.
Wrathful.
Right? Mm-hmm. And then you start entering the post-Enlightenment era where Mormonism was born, and you have this legalistic God. And even if you look at the way clerics dressed during the time, you know, in the 19th century America, they dressed the same way like judges did, with robes and collars and even wigs. That's the way Protestant ministers would dress. As opposed to the old medieval church, they dressed in the form of royalty, right? The representatives of God. And now we've moved beyond that, and we kind of don't know. If you go to Deseret Book, you have all these smiling Jesus things, because right. It's still this... That's one model, but then you have the model of Jesus as the ideal man, really. Mm-hmm. You know, he's handsome, he's strong. Whatever we think is the ideal masculinity, that's mm-hmm. who Jesus is. But because the church was born in 1830, where ideas of masculinity and authority and femininity and the patriarchy are changing so rapidly, it's like we have a schizophrenic God and we don't know which one it is anymore.
Well, and you're so right that there's this idea of when we worship God in a Mormon setting, I think people think we're all talking about the same thing, and we sure the hell aren't. We aren't talking about the same thing at all.
Well, to that point, when Mormons start talking to me about Jesus, I have no idea what they believe. And they,
right.
And they'll get angry at that, but I'm not trying to be a dick. I'm trying to say there's so many different patterns of belief about Jesus. Just saying, and this is what I think the Mormon church is running into a problem philosophically as they try to emphasize Jesus. Everyone else is like, I don't know what you're talking about. And the Mormons say, no, we're just like everyone else. And then you can ask them a few simple questions. All right, you worship Jesus like the rest of us. Yes, we do. Well, can I pray to Jesus? Oh.
Yeah, or what about the Trinity? Oh. No. You know. So yeah, it is a different perspective and it, within different Christian sects, but even with inside Mormonism as well. I think our theology, though, is so... It's so ripe and rich for so many different ideas of Jesus and God and what that can look like. And that's actually one of the things I like about Mormonism is that we generally don't have a strong authority over theology. We have a strong authority over legal orthopraxy and how you do and what you do and what you dress and how you say things. But we don't have a strong authority over what you think and the story and the narrative and the idea, as long as it doesn't threaten the legalistic aspects. You know, you're going to kind of be okay. And I personally like the idea that we don't have like a theology department of the church. The last thing I want is the church to create a department that's over theology, because I like the idea of having the liberty to imagine what I'm talking about when I'm talking about God. You know, it also is a feminist issue too, because a lot of women will say, oh, they need to reveal more about Heavenly Mother. And I'm thinking the last thing I want to hear from the prophet's mouth is revelation about a female deity. No, thank you. I'd rather hear it from the mouth of her daughters.
I had this very discussion with a woman at Sunstone last weekend, and you know, she was talking about how she likes the women, you know, my mind's going blank. Folks like Margaret Toscano,
Maxine Haines.
Maxine Haines,
yes,
who have kind of divulged into feminine theology. I really like that, but I'm with you. I was telling this woman, the church really doesn't have any concept of the mother in heaven. It's just something that's mentioned. It's like Kolob.
Well, it's almost like a placeholder for, well, yeah, we all got to have lots of babies, so we need this placeholder over mm-hmm. here. And we'll keep that placeholder there because it's useful for upholding heteronormative patriarchy.
Right. It's absolutely. It's, you know, the old Indian thing. I oftentimes will throw out the line turtles all the way down, but I should level set on this podcast, which is there's an old trope or whatever that says that the earth is on the back of an elephant, which is standing on the back of a turtle, and that's how it is. It's an old Indian philosophy. And then the question is, well, what's the turtle standing on? And the joke response is, well, after that, it's turtles
all the way down.
and we have the same sort of problem with some of these things. You put these placeholders like the mother in heaven. They're not defined. She's just there because we need that. But Mormon theology really doesn't have anything to say about the mother in heaven. And to your point, we don't want them to.
I know. Well, at least me personally. I will speak for myself and not all women. But the last thing I want is some man telling me about the God I'm supposed to become. I'd rather hear from other women and envision that potential myself. And actually, that's one of the things I do love about transhumanism as well, or at least religious transhumanism and the idea of theosis and becoming gods and all sorts of things. is that it has a definitely a more inclusive and communal perspective of this idea that lots of people get to become gods. It's not just the patriarch, wrathful, mean god up in the earth. It's that we all get to rise and elevate as gods together. And there's lots of room in Mormon theology for that narrative if we were so, you know, inclined to use it. But
so for the transhumanists, what does it look like? I mean, we're talking these interesting philosophy things, and I imagine you guys in a coffee shop drinking coffee. And, you know, I talked to the other, you know, there's about, in this world, maybe about 250 of us who are actually interested in Mormon philosophy. And we often say, it wouldn't be great if we could get together in a coffee house and argue this stuff. Of course, we always say it'll never happen. It'll never hold. So what does this look like for you guys? How do you get together and argue philosophy?
No, that's a great question. Well, first I'll just iterate that, our demographics are really strange in that we have everything from true believing Latter-day Saints to atheists to never Mormons. So we have a broad group of people within the organization. And we do actually get together and we talk philosophy and nerd out over technology and all sorts of other things too. We have a monthly meetup. It's the second Sunday of every month and we hold it on Sunday nights, and it's actually at my cousin's house. And we get together and we talk about these kinds of things. We usually have a topic at hand, and usually one person leads the discussion or gives a brief presentation, and then we discuss it from there. But it's exactly what you're talking about. It's this idea of discussing better ideas of, or well, yeah, I'll say better ways of interpreting Mormon theology and what the implications are with science and technology and where this is going. And it's a really fun conversation because it's very rare to be able to get your faithful Latter-day Saint and your ex-Mormon atheist in the same room and be able to have a constructive conversation about these things. And strangely, the MTA does it. Like, I know of no other group right now within the Mormon sphere, the big Mormon sphere, that is able to accomplish the kind of discussions that Mormon transhumanists are. It could be, and I don't mean this to sound too snobbish, but it could be that on average, our demographics show that we are more we have more degrees than the average member. And even the average church member has more degrees than the average person in society. So demographically speaking, we are a highly educated group.
Bunch of smarty pants.
I know, that was super rude. I shouldn't have said that.
It speaks to people who are interested in this sort of thing. You know, I think when we use the word smart, I always try to make the distinction between like intelligence and knowledge, and you know, ignorance is a function of knowledge. So it's not that I think most of the population doesn't have the mental capacity. They don't have the interest, or they don't have the background to be able to,
or even the means, Like, let's be honest. I mean, in getting a philosophy degree, that is a status of privilege. That is my privilege that I'm able to get.
You guys aren't yeah. You don't exclude.
Of course not. Actually, that's been one of my main projects as a board member, and when I was CEO, is making transhumanism accessible to people as a story. So not just the technology. I'm not a technologist, so I'm not going to pretend to know. I know everything about technology. But as a story and as a philosophy, I feel like transhumanism needs to be an accessible story. And that's part of what my work has been to do, to be able to translate this in a language that people can understand and get on board with. The basic idea being, heaven is a place on earth. We've all been prophesied to be gods, and we need to do that through love and through the example of Jesus Christ. If we can do that, we could make the world a really super cool place with science and technology. That's the story.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Anson Park, Executive Director of the Sunstone Education Foundation. I want to invite you to our weekly Sunstone Firesides. Do you remember those? Firesides that they used to have dating all the way back to the 1930s, when the LDS Church would hold monthly meetings to discuss really important gospel topics. Those meetings became known endearingly as Firesides. In January of 2019, Sunstone launched a new podcast that incorporates a nod to these firesides. Featuring a weekly evening podcast, it will display a range of hosts, all women, as they chat with diverse guests from across the Mormon spectrum. The hosts are all female-identifying that represent a broad perspective in Mormonism. These podcasts will be released every Thursday evening, so you can have that fireside feel brought right into your living room. So grab a cup of cocoa or coffee, since at Sunstone there is more than one way to Mormon. snuggle up under a blanket, and listen to incredible interviews by and from incredible people. You can support women and their work in Mormon studies, which is desperately needed, by donating at sunstone.org or becoming a monthly subscriber. Go to sunstone.org and click on the podcast tab for more info. We hope you enjoy it as much as we do.
Okay, so if people who want to get involved, this is a podcast, so I recognize that a lot of my people listening out here are introverts. So they like to engage things at a distance before they engage them in person. So somebody who's piqued their interest, where should they go?
Well, you can first start at our website. Our website has all sorts of information on it, how you can become a member. It has what I call the Mormon Transhumanist Canon, which has our declaration and affirmation. That's the only thing people have to assign and agree to become a member of the association. So start at the website.
So what do they have to affirm?
Oh, okay, yeah. They affirm the Mormon Transhumanist affirmation and the Transhumanist Declaration. And the affirmation is composed of 5 points, and we encourage diverse interpretation of what that is.
Do you know
is.
Those points offhand?
So, oh gosh, right offhand, no. I'd have to look it up.
What sort of things?
It's basically, we believe that we should use science and technology to help people. Mm. We believe that we should take a most immersive role in discipleship in Christ, that we should actually do these things. Things like that. And again, this doesn't necessarily require literal belief in anything as well. We have lots of atheists and things like that, but if people do have literal belief, we highly welcome that as well. So we encourage diverse interpretation of our, I'm using air quotes, canon, right? The affirmation and declaration. So definitely read those, check those out. The other thing you'll find on our website is what's are called primers. And this is for transhumanist newbies. And they're just short little snippet lessons, almost like just like a blog post about, hey, these are some key element points of Mormon transhumanism. You can take those in and adjust those, digest those as you wish. That's actually a project that I worked on with a couple other board members at the association, and they've done an excellent job of like trying to create bite-sized chunks for people to like start to understand Mormon transhumanism. So that's a good place to start. If you want to be a little more interactive, we have our Facebook group. You can come there, or we have our YouTube channel. And our YouTube channel is awesome because you can go listen to all the past talks of people who have spoken at our conferences. And we have some big hitters, like Bushman has come to speak at our conferences. We have Givens. We have all sorts of interesting people have come to speak at our conference before. And so all those conference talks are on our YouTube channel for anyone to enjoy. So that's one way to start participating. Another way is to actually come to our conference. Our conference is super nerdy and super awesome and super niche, but I'm telling you, if there were ever a place where the Atheist Exmo and the TBM Latter-day Saint can get in the same room and have productive, interesting conversations, this is the place that where it happens.
When and where do you do your conference?
So our conference usually have been around general conference time in April, but we're actually thinking of switching it this year to the summertime. So we don't have our date for our next conference. We just had our annual conference this last April. So the next summer coming up, we will be sure to post it. And anyone who follows me on Facebook, I'll be Facebooking it, and you can check on our website. But it'll likely be this next summer. Besides that, if you're local in Utah, you can always come to one of our meetups, which, again, really interesting conversations happening. Definitely it's really fun to get, I call them investigators. You know, they'll come and want to hear what Mormon transhumanism is about, and their eyes just get so wide. And then when their mind's blown, and they're just like, I didn't know there were Mormons like this. So it's definitely an interesting experience. But there's lots of ways to get involved, and you can always just PM me and ask, and I'll shoot you in the right direction.
Well, fantastic. And I'll say, and I've been guilty of this, sometimes we characterize Mormons by the corporate church or by the majority political stand or by even commonly held beliefs. But Mormons are a much more diverse and complicated group of individuals than all of our models give them credit for. And I think this is one way to explore that.
Yeah, thank you so much for saying that. I genuinely and sincerely appreciate that because, I don't know, maybe it's because I'm bisexual and I can't make up my mind, but I don't consider myself fully in and I don't consider myself fully out of the church, but I consider myself fully Mormon and I'm still very much Mormon and I identify as a Mormon transhumanist. That is my religion and that is part of the Mormon umbrella. And so acknowledging that these diverse parts of Mormonism exist, I think, are a great way to empower some minority Mormon groups that I feel like are functioning in a really productive way.
I think so. If I look back in my history, there's a time I would have empathized with saying being inside and out. And then I went through a phase where I really considered myself outside. And now my phase is that I think it's an artificial distinction. There's no such thing as Mormons or ex-Mormons or whatever. We're all human beings trying different models of approaching what it means to be human, what it means to be a collective, what it means to be social, what it means to be a capitalist, all these sort of things.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing these models that are fake. So for me, yes, I'm Mormon, and no, I'm not Mormon, and
right.
I don't find the division compelling anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think we're just, it's the same coin, and we just have two sides of it.
Right.
So, well, it's been fascinating talking to you guys. I will consider if I'm going to come out. I will tell you, you know, I'm always just share my mind without...
You should definitely come to our next conference. I will send you a personal invitation.
Not with the Mormonism or not with the Christianity or embracing the message of Jesus. Jesus was a good guy.
Uh-huh.
I think that for me, I've become rather sort of passively anti-technology. I say passively anti-technology. I'm sitting in a room talking into a microphone, and I work with technology in my job. But I'm becoming very skeptical about the idea that technology is going
to
save us.
Oh my gosh, we have to talk about that. Now that you've said it, you've opened Pandora's box. Let's talk about it. So, I would agree with you. I don't think technology alone will save us. But what about it has made you become or feel? I'm like role reverser now. I'm going to interview you. what is it about technology?
Well, I'm going to give you a brief. We should probably come back and continue this discussion,
no.
or I should go to your next. Maybe I'll volunteer my services. Go to your conference. I'll be the straw man anti-Luddite.
Excellent.
And then you guys can all try to beat up, convince me I'm wrong, sort of thing.
Perfect.
I just think that technology almost universally solves one problem and creates two new problems. You know, let's take something like aging. We were talking about.
Yeah.
I'm to the point where I want people to live comfortable, healthy lives, but mm-hmm. I don't think we should really extend human life. I don't think we'll gain anything. As a matter of fact, I think like scientific progress has been shown to be propelled along by the death of the stalwarts who had old theories. You know,
right?
You couldn't beat Piaget until he was dead, and then, mm-hmm. then you didn't have to beat Piaget anymore.
So this is the thing that I always come up with people when people bring up this type of concern. It's one, we already are extending life beyond what it was.
I know.
Our hands with soap and water and things like that, we go to the doctor's office and things like that. And when people have cancer, we try to help them. So we already are. So the question isn't, should we or should we not? The question is, how far is too far? And the thought experiment is this. And I gave this to one of my peers at school once. And he really chewed on it for a while because he was very much convinced that there was a day he's going to want to eventually die, you know, and he doesn't want to be extended forever into all eternity. And so the question is this: if tomorrow I could give you a pill and that pill gave you the opportunity to live a healthy, long, wonderful life for that day, would you take that pill that day?
Yes. I feel like you're starting path for me to a trap. Yes. Okay, Socrates,
so,
go ahead.
So you take the pill that day, and the next day I have the same pill. It's right here for you. That pill will enable you to live healthy, active, and extend your life that day. Probably, you might take it again, no?
Yes.
The question is, down the road, if you could do it, oh, this pill will extend you for a week. Okay, sure, yeah, I have a week's worth full of stuff to do. I'll extend my life one more week. And let's say, okay, I have one more year. Yeah, there's a lot I want to get done this year. I will extend my life one year. The question is, will there ever be the next day that you say, no, I don't want that pill anymore? And I'm not saying that they aren't people that aren't. We have people that commit suicide. So obviously there are people who do not want to live. So the argument is not, do people want to live? The argument is, should we give people the option to take the pill every day or not? Should everyone have that choice?
Well, I think there's too many people I don't want taking that pill. It's not me I'm worried about.
But we were talking about universal accessibility.
Yes, I realize that. Well, obviously, as we've shown, fascinating ideas. And in terms of science and philosophies, you and I have talked before, these for philosophers, and I would consider myself an armchair philosopher because these sort of ideas are very fascinating to me. And I know there's been a lot of people who present to me their philosophy, and I immediately ask them a question that kind of deconstructs the whole thing in an asshole sort of way. But it's really me trying to get to the heart. I want you to convince me. When I engage with anybody, I want them to convince me that I'm wrong. And I really appreciate that there's space for this, and you guys are willing to engage. And I've talked to different folks who caucus with you, and they're all to a person just really interesting. So thank you so much for being out there and giving this avenue. I've really become tired of the polemics of you're either trying to prove the church is not true or prove it's true, because we're missing all the interesting things in that stupid false dichotomy.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. This has been so much fun, and I'm totally going to give you a personal invitation to our next conference.
Well, I will commit to come to at least one of them. I really love to explore these things and see what you guys have to say.
Awesome.
Well, it's been a pleasure as always to talk to you. Come back real soon. We have other philosophical things, and Blair, for those who don't know, she is just a dynamo. You're on the board of directors of Sunstone, of the Transhumanists. You're involved in a lot of things, an advocate for the LGBT community, particularly strongly advocating for bisexuals, which are kind of this forgotten, lost population that gets dismissed. So you're out there fighting the fight. And I know from my own personal experience that takes its toll in terms of weariness and depression and anxiety and things that of trying to change the world that just doesn't want to get changed. So thank you so much from the bottom of my heart for being out there and fighting the fight.
Oh my gosh, thank you. This was a pleasure.
Indeed. All right, thanks.